Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Timon B. Wallace takes his lifelong efforts for peace and the future of the planet to new depths and heights with his book, Warheads to Windmills, Preventing Climate Catastrophe and Nuclear War. In the book, Tim examines in thorough detail the threats that both nuclear weapons and climate change hold for the future of our planet, and then the wide range of factors and costs implicit in our weaponry and energy sources, leading to a meticulous consideration of the agenda that will maximize the possibility of saving humans and the Earth, essentially beating swords into plowshares. Tim has spent his life building the tools of peace and getting rid of the weapons of war. Tim's PhD is in peace studies, and he's worked with Peace Brigades International, Peace Workers UK, Nonviolent Peace Force, and the Peace and Disarmament for Quaker Peace and Social Witness in the UK. He is currently Executive Director of NuclearBan.us. He joins us today via Zoom from Northampton, Massachusetts. Tim, it's great to have you back for Spirit in Action.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How are things sitting over there in Northampton?
Well, the spring is just starting to get sprung. I don't know how it is up in northern Wisconsin, but today's the first sort of warm, sunny day we've had this year, so we're making the most of it.
If I asked you, could you go into a full-on Scottish accent?
If I speak fit like they do in the north of Scotland where I lived, you didn't understand a word of it again.
I'm thinking that you've lived in enough different places. You pass pretty well for an American accent, but you know, your time in England as well. You are a man of the world, and that's not even talking about all the other countries throughout the world you've lived in.
Well, I've lived most of my life in the UK, in London. But yeah, I've lived all over, and my accent's a bit of a mess, I know.
Well, I do think that there's something in that for the objective of world peace, which I think is so near to your heart. I don't know if it makes a difference if you speak to people in a Scottish accent when you're in Sri Lanka, for instance. Does that hurt or help?
That's an interesting question, actually. In most places, you know, people understand Scotland as being different from the British Empire and the, you know, British. So, yeah, but I can't really turn a Scottish accent on and off at will, I'm afraid. I had to understand it when I was in school, in high school, but, you know, that was a long time ago.
I'm thinking that perhaps Timon Wallace is a bit of a polymath. And I say that because I know about your musical side, the area you could have chosen instead of your activism bent. But the thing that really convinced me is this new book, Warheads to Windmills, Preventing Climate Catastrophe and Nuclear War. When I talked to you back in 2017, we were talking about nuclear war, nuclear treaties, your work with ICANN, all of that. This book, as I read through it, I was amazed at the depth of the information you went into. I have a physics background. I've taught physics at university level and so on. And so a lot of it, for me, made pretty good sense. And I also am a math major, and I'm also a speech communications major, all these kind of things. It seems to me that...
You're also a polymath.
But you are something of a polymath to have this much grasp of the detail. And I'm not just talking about the physics principles, but the political organization. Where does all that come from? Is that just part of your past, or did you just really bone up for it really well for this book?
Well, I did a lot of research for the book and for the different, you know, iterations of it. But, you know, I started out, apart from the music, which I did very early on when I was a music teacher, you know, I did a degree in human ecology. So I go way back in terms of environmental issues and trying to understand those. And then I did a PhD in peace studies. Back in the 80s, I was totally immersed in the nuclear issue. So all those have helped me in putting it all together as best I could.
But I don't know if I heard one of those areas of study which involves the degree of math and physics understanding that this book betrays. You're really conceiving of how electrical loads and where this energy is siphons off and what its costs are down the line. This is broad thinking. Was this your thinking, or was this, you know, maybe it was Vicky, your wife's help, or Asher, or Andwin, or...
Help, yep. You know, and I've read, I don't know if you're familiar with Mark Jacobson at Stanford University, but I used a lot of his work on clean energy. And I've had correspondence with him and asked him questions and met with him finally when we were out in California recently. You know, there are some really excellent resources out there. It's not just, you know, me making it up.
Well, and again, about not making it up, it strikes me that you have thoroughly documented this one. And a lot of people will wave their hands. Oh, it would be nice to turn warheads into windmills, right? That could be an airy-fairy liberal point of view as caricatured from conservative side. This is not at all airy-fairy. This is very precise and clear.
Well, the goal of this book was to really lay it out as best I possibly could and provide, as you said, all the sources and references. There's nearly 1,000 footnotes in this book to let people follow up if they don't believe what I'm saying, or they want more information, or they want to know where the original source is. You know, I've tried as best I could to give that, because this is mostly a handbook for campaigners and activists to be able to have access to the information. I've tried to make it as accessible as possible. I mean, it's got a lot of information in there, as you say, but I hope it's accessible for people who want to use it. And I wanted to really, you know, nail down some of these things so that we can really justify them and explain them to people.
I think I'm going to take a scattergun approach to, again, a bad metaphor to use when you're anti-militaristic, but a scattergun approach to grabbing bits and pieces of the book, hopefully to stimulate people's interest in dealing with the immense material in here. The overview, though, is you've been concerned about nuclear weapons, nuclear arms, for a long, long time, as you said, 1980s. This book particularly brings in an area that I didn't know you were interested in, and that has to do with the burgeoning climate catastrophe and alternative energy sources. So is that something new to your repertoire, or is that something you've had along the way, just happened, I haven't noticed it?
Well, as I said, I started out more as an environmental activist in, you know, back in the 70s. With, you know, the Limits to Growth book and, you know, all those kinds of issues. So I've been following it, but, you know, I did take a deep dive for this book and for the previous version. We put a first edition out in 2019, which was just a slim report, really, basically outlining this concept of warheads to windmills. And then I put another one out before the final book came out. But yeah, I mean, I feel as strongly about the climate crisis as I do about the nuclear crisis, because they're both existential threats to the whole planet, and we've got to deal with both of them. And the great thing is that we could do both together, and that's what the book is about. How is that really possible?
They are both existential threats. I think they feel very different, because nuclear weapons, in a few minutes, basically it's over. And the climate catastrophe is going to unfold over the next decades. So is it hard mentally for you to put them in the same package?
Well, I talk about them as we can go fast or we can go slow, but, you know, we've got to address both of them. And they are, of course, many, many differences, but there are also connections, and that's what I'm trying to highlight here for people. I mean, one of the goals of the book and of our campaign is to interest climate activists in the nuclear issue, because, you know, climate is much more to the fore these days. It's much more on the minds of younger people. People aren't thinking about the nuclear issue in the same way, with the same urgency. And so I'm trying to put those together in people's minds, that they are both existential threats and we have to address both of them.
When I talked to you back in 2017, one of the things that was right on the horizon was Kim Jong-un and the possible nuclear war. Well, since then, he and Trump become good buddies, right? But now Trump's not in office. It is interesting to see how the urgent threat that's facing us morphs over the decades, over the years. Does one or the other feel bigger or lesser to you at this moment in terms of threat?
You mean in terms of nuclear weapons or climate, or do you mean in terms
nuclear weapons, climate, but also, I mean, one of the things that's looming for me is democracy going to continue in this country to the degree that it is here?
There's so many issues, and that's one of the challenges. I mean, right now, everybody's focused very much on Gaza and the catastrophe been unfolding there. The Ukraine war is still, I mean, these are potentially flashpoints for nuclear war, including what's happening right now between Israel and Iran. And North Korea hasn't gone away. You know, I mean, it's still a flashpoint. But what I'm trying to do is keep the focus on the bigger picture, which is that unless we survive as a planet, we're not going to be able to deal with any of these things. And, the Ukraine war, for example, wars are terrible, and I've worked in war zones, and I know what it's like, and I'm totally against all wars, and the next one before it happens. But, wars don't end life on Earth. The problem with Ukraine is that this is pitting the U.S. and Russia against each other in a very, very tense and dangerous way. All kinds of breakdown in communication and so on is just raising the danger of nuclear war. And the same is the case right now with Israel and Iran. I mean, Israel has nuclear weapons. Iran is very close to having nuclear weapons. And, that could escalate. So these are danger points. But the bigger picture is we've got to address the nuclear weapons that are what make war existential threat and not just another war.
Your book is organized by sections in a way that helps us think about the separate pieces and then puts them together. First, you talk about climate, then you talk about nuclear weapons, and then you talk about the conversion warheads to windmills, and then you talk about how do we actually implement this. So four discrete steps, if you will. I think you must be an organized person. Is that true?
Well, I try to be organized in my thinking, at least. I don't know if I'm organized on my desk.
Well, the sign is organized desk, sign of a sick mind. So, in which case, I'm safe from sickness. But let's talk about the climate crisis and some of the pieces of it. Again, a scattershot will be my approach because there's little pieces throughout it that you document in very useful detail. As you said, as a campaign booklet, this gives you the information you need. So, climate crisis, right now the projections are that if we have to reach net zero by 2050 in order to limit the degree to a 1.5 degree Celsius rise in temperature, right? But that means that something like 45% has to be cut by 2030. Lay out that vision, if you would.
Well, this is the vision of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, these numbers in terms of what has to happen. And we're not anywhere near on track with that. And the years are rolling by. As you said, we need to cut emissions in half by 2030, and they're still going up, not down, globally. So, I laid out in the book what has to happen in the short term between now and 2030 to really make a deep, deep cuts in our carbon emissions. And, that's basically targeting electricity generation, where, almost a quarter of all carbon emissions come from fossil fuel power plants, and road transportation, where more than 10% globally and much more than that in the U.S. comes from cars and trucks on the road, pumping out carbon from burning gasoline and diesel and so on, and heating of buildings. I mean, those are the three absolute priority areas. And then, there's much more that has to be done in the medium term to get to 2050 to really address agriculture and industrial emissions and so on. But unless we make those really deep, rapid cuts in those key areas that I laid out, those are totally possible. We've got the technologies. We can do this. We just have to do it. And we're not doing it.
Is China going to meet those goals?
Nope, not at the moment. But, you know, one of the points I make in the book is, you know, it's very easy to point a finger at China and say, you know, they're the largest carbon emitter. They got to do it, you know, and we're only second. But, you know, the reality is we got to work together on this. China's emissions, I mean, President Biden has been trying, and Trump before him, you know, have been trying to sanction China, to cut imports from China, to make the Inflation Reduction Act, which we may go down to if we have time, you know, requires all the new technologies to meet the carbon emissions standards have to come from the U.S. and not from China, when the reality is the U.S. is still importing more goods from China than from any other country. And, you know, China makes 85% of the solar panels and 80% of the electric vehicle batteries. And, you know, like, we've got to work together. And the pollution, the carbon emissions in China are in a large part because they're making stuff for us.
There are pollution.
Our pollution, exactly.
Well, and that is one of the things you talk about so very incisively in Warheads to Windmills. One of the problems we have is indirect, and we're not accounting for where pollution comes from, goes to where it can actually be controlled. So as long as the U.S. says, hey, we didn't pollute, China did it, that's an easy out, but it doesn't help the world at all.
Right. And of course, you know, just like nuclear war, which no matter where it happens, it's going to affect all of us. You know, I mean, even if India and Pakistan have a nuclear war, you know, the rest of the world is going to suffer. The same with carbon. You can't just say, well, we're going to stop producing carbon in this country and pretend that that's not going to keep the globe from warming.
Talk a little bit about the importance of this indirect or inadequate accounting of where carbon comes from. And by the way, we're used to speaking in terms of carbon. I hadn't before seen the numbering, the essentially it's carbon equivalents, because methane, for instance, is something like 20 times worse, I understand, in terms of its heat holding ability, the way that it'll heat up our environment. So you have all this measuring that I hadn't seen before about where is the carbon effect really coming from, going to? And there's a lot of thought in this. So talk a little bit about the sources you mentioned already. And military, we shouldn't forget to mention them.
Because there's so many different ways of doing these counting and sources and so on, I've tried to be consistent in using what I already mentioned, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a massive collection of climate scientists work together to try to come up with these figures. And there is a table in the book in the first section on climate, which you probably saw, which I can't find anywhere. I mean, it doesn't exist. It's all numbers from the IPCC, but they don't put them in one place. They're scattered over literally thousands of pages of IPCC reports that document where our carbon emissions are coming from globally. I mean, we know the US figures more accurately because they do produce them. But even those figures, as you were just saying, there's some loopholes in there. One of them is military emissions, which countries are not required to provide because of national security, so-called. So it means, you know, we have some good ideas, and there are independent researchers, you know, looking into this and trying to calculate what the emissions are from the military, which are high, but we don't know because they're not counted. And the other huge emission, well, there's other ones, but, you know, the other really important one is that there's all these attempts to count biomass as a neutral form of electricity generation. So, you know, biofuels, you know, using corn oil or whatever to make fuel for vehicles, burning wood chips or organic matter to produce electricity or heating, you know, these are considered in the intergovernmental system as being neutral. And the reality is that they're pumping carbon out at the same rate and sometimes greater rate than fossil fuel burning. So again, I've tried to cover this in the book, you know, all these different hidden emissions and so on. But we know roughly, I mean, we know the overall picture and we know what we have to do. So these are just additional things to take into consideration. And we know that the vast majority of emissions come from burning fossil fuels, and that's what we got to address.
You also give some special consideration to nuclear power, because I've had guests, it was maybe 10 years ago now, who is very strong environmentalist, but who is believing that nuclear energy, as in power plants, would be the solution for the climate change. Now, you address that. You don't come up with the same conclusion.
No, I don't. For a number of reasons. And this is why, you know, the book gets longer and longer, because, you know, none of these are simple issues. They're complicated. And I want to really make sure that I justify what I put in there. But nuclear power, I mean, apart from its relation with nuclear weapons and what we're seeing in Ukraine, for instance, with the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in the middle of a war zone. I mean, these are complicated issues already. But purely in terms of addressing the climate crisis, the reality is that nuclear power is, first of all, not clean. It's not renewable. It's not a fast solution. It takes a long time. The first nuclear plant to be opened in this country for 20 years just opened in Georgia, and it took more than 20 years to get the permissions and build that plant. And, you know, one of the arguments for nuclear power that I heard is, well, we can speed up all this process and, you know, bypass all the safety regulations and so on. And that scares me more than the idea that people think that this is a solution. I mean, nuclear power, I have to admit, in countries like France, which rely very, very heavily on nuclear power, like more than 70 or 80%, I can't remember the exact figure, of their electricity comes from nuclear power. They're not going to transition overnight, you know, and shut all their nuclear power plants, which Germany has done, as you probably know, and other countries in Europe have done, completely eliminated nuclear power from their grid. The US, you know, has about 100 plants at the moment, nuclear plants. They're not going to all shut down at once. And, you know, they do provide a certain amount of the transition that we need to move off fossil fuels, because we could shut down a lot of the fossil fuel plants tomorrow. And we have reserve capacity in this country for, you know, including from nuclear power. But in terms of a long-term solution or even a short-term solution, building huge numbers of more nuclear power plants is just not a solution. And I explain it in more detail in the book.
Well, that was one of the figures that I was struck by. The amount of energy going into a nuclear power plant, the amount of energy you have to spend to make that power come back out, is immense. At one point, I was looking at the numbers. It looked like, because you were dealing with gigawatts versus gigawatt hours, it was confusing to me. But because the energy to put into it looked like it was 10 times what you were getting. But actually, that was comparing hours to watt hours.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it gets technical. But I mean, the energy cliff, I think that's fascinating. And most people don't know about that, that the amount of energy it takes to enrich uranium is enormous. Totally enormous. And as more uranium gets mined, the grade of the uranium goes down because there's less of it to dig out of the ground. And it requires more and more refining until you reach this cliff, which means that you're actually putting more energy in than you're ever going to get out, which is crazy. It's just crazy.
Well, it's kind of like parallel between using oil or shale oil or those kind of things. You know, as your reserves dwindle, you use lower quality stuff and it takes more energy and work to get it out, right? So overall, again, climate crisis is threatening. We're going by the IPCC overtake, which is a whole lot of scientists refining, continuing adding in knowledge in a way that seems pretty dependable. By the way, I still say that we may not have any climate crisis because, for instance, the Yellowstone supervolcano may emit so much particulates into the air that we have an ice age condition instead. There's, you know, I always reserve that there's a 10% chance that climate change is going to be very much opposite of what we think. How confident do you feel that there's climate crisis coming if we don't correct our energy usage?
Oh, well, first of all, you know, if the Yellowstone volcano goes, I mean, we're going to have other very, very serious problems. But I mean, we cannot leave the climate crisis as if it's not an existential threat. I mean, we have to address it. That's my view.
Partly what I've come down to is if I'm driving a car and there's a 10% chance I will not die, but 90% chance I will die, I'll take my best action to reduce that 90% chance, right? I'm going to take whatever action I can. And people who just want to say, well, it might work itself out, but it looks 90% chance it's going to crash. Well, come on. Nobody does that except people who are extremely short-sighted. I think this book is about extending our sight so we can see more of the pieces where we're going. And some people are going to resist that. They want an easy answer. Have you had that reaction from people you've presented the book to? Don't bother me with all these facts. I've got my opinions.
That's certainly a prevalent view, and those people aren't reading my book. They won't pick it up, and they won't come to my talks. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how to reach them. These are things people don't want to talk about and want to shut away. I mean, it's scary, it's depressing, it's discouraging to think that we're in this mess. But we have the solutions, that's the thing. We have a way of fixing this. And so I really want to focus on that and not dwell too much on the threat. But I mean, we have to face up to those threats. And we have to realize that this is urgent, it's serious, we've got to do something, we've got to do it now. And this is what we can do. We've got the solutions.
One of the comments you make in the book, which was glaring, I think it's probably true, but you said, the only reason nuclear power has remained a viable option for many decades is because it's been heavily subsidized, and the main purpose of that subsidization was to make weapons-grade plutonium. Is that a fact? And how do we know that?
That's a fact historically, and can certainly, I mean, I don't remember offhand what references I put in there, but I've tried to document everything in the book with some reference or other. But the main subsidy for nuclear power, as you probably know, is the Anderson Act, which basically limits the liability of the nuclear power utilities from any kind of accident. Because otherwise, I mean, the cost that, you know, Fukushima, for instance, their liabilities in the billions and billions from one accident. And, you know, with 100 nuclear power plants, all of which could have an accident, I mean, the risk may be remote, but it's still a risk. And so insurance companies simply, I mean, we would not have any nuclear power plants in this country if the government didn't step in and say, we'll cover the insurance over a certain amount, because otherwise we couldn't afford to have it. And the initial impetus for nuclear power in this country was unquestionably to make the plutonium for the nuclear weapons. That's how it all got going. And of course, it was great for the nuclear physicists to feel that there was this atoms for peace and not just atoms for war. And the idea that we could sort of do something useful with this technology was very important for them from their own moral self-esteem. But now, you know, as I said, it's more complicated. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of reasons why companies want nuclear power, which is partly because it's a very centralized, concentrated form of energy that gives them the control. And as you probably know, in the Inflation Reduction Act, there's billions for subsidizing nuclear power right now, because it's actually the most expensive form of electricity generation. So they wouldn't be choosing nuclear power unless the government's saying, well, we want you to have it, so here's some few extra billions to build more nuclear power plants.
It is so ludicrous to go in that direction, except that there's a very human tendency that says, if I invested this much money in it, I have to risk some more money so I don't lose my initial investment. We talked about the amount of energy that goes into refining uranium to be able to use it, so that it's not the energy gift that some people think it is. Is the same true of solar power? To make a panel on my house, how much energy do I get out of that panel versus how much energy it took to create the panel?
That is a very good question, which I don't have the answer to. I mean, I know that there have been lots of studies on the sort of comparative carbon emissions, because, of course, at the moment, you know, to make solar panels, to make electric vehicles, to make the batteries, all of these require mining, milling, transportation, construction. And at the moment, all that is still being done with fossil fuels. And so to put a solar panel on your roof to generate electricity, you know, making that solar panel and getting it onto your roof has used a certain amount of carbon, but it's nowhere near the amount of carbon that would be used if you weren't using, I mean, if you were using fossil fuel to create the electricity. So I don't know in terms of energy per se, but that's an interesting question, which I will look into.
So you needed to consult me, Tim, during the writing of the book. By the way, folks, we are speaking to Timon Wallace. The website you want to check out right now about his new book is warheadstowindmills.org. The book is Warheads to Windmills, Preventing Climate Catastrophe and Nuclear War. I did have Timon here back in 2017 because he was talking about the new treaty, the treaty recently agreed upon, and you talked about some numbers. I want to follow up on that because the number of nations who had signed on to it, who they then have to ratify it, and then more nations are coming on. I want to talk about that in a moment. But folks, you'll find that interview with Tim on my site, northernspiritradio.org. You'll also find links to a number of sites related to Tim. The best one to find him at right now is nuclearban.us. And you'll find him on probably 20 other sites because he's also written and done an immense amount of activism. One of my favorites, though, is boldsongs.com. You're going to find that. And I have to ask you, Tim, for a song that you wrote related to Warheads to Windmills, because in my interview with you last time, I did include one with you about swords into plowshares. So all of this information, again, is on NordenspiritRadio.org. All these links, you can find Tim and his books and his activism and his songs, all of that connected, as well as for all my other guests the past 18 and a half years. There's a rich amount of information and connection you can do via my site. Please post a comment when you visit, because two-way communication is the best kind. It's my voice is of limited use in the world without your voice joined in. Together, we can make immense changes. So please post a comment when you come. Support us if you're able. We do this work because of love of the work that we're doing, but we also need your help for it to be sustainable. We don't take money from corporations or actually from government either. And part of the purpose is that we want to keep our motive clear. We want to serve people, not certain institutions. And that's one of the big dangers that certainly happens with all kinds of work. Last of all, I want to remind you of the 35 or so stations nationwide that carry Northern Spirit Radio programs. Remember to support them. Our alternative forms of information, news, and media make an immense difference in terms of getting out the word, that which serves the people to the people. So please support them if you're at all able. And I'm going to come right back then to you, Tim, and ask you about how do you finance something like this? I don't know how many hours went into this, but it looks to me like it would have been worthy of a $10 million subsidization from government or from a university to write this book. How do you fund this kind of thing?
Well, sadly, no government or philanthropic organization will support this work. We've tried, and I'm semi-retired. I do all this with no pay. We have raised some money through nuclearban.us and been able to hire, you know, researchers and other help from time to time. We've had to publish this ourselves, so it's on a print-on-demand, so there's no upfront costs to that. You know, people buy a book and they print it and send it to them. We've been selling books, so they're available in bookshops and online, and we haven't needed any money for that, which is one of the benefits of modern technology. But funding is difficult, and we scramble around and find what we can.
But one of the costs is supposed to be white hair, and your hair isn't as white as mine. Is that just because of genetics? Maybe it's a Scottish thing? I don't know. I do know that there's an expense in terms of life energy that you've put into this. And not just you. Again, I mentioned the other people like Asher and Anduin and Vicky. A lot of people put immense portions of their lives into making this possible. And it's an act of love.
Yeah, it is. And we continue to do that.
Did you write a song, or have you written songs related to this since you've been putting the book together?
No. This has been very all-consuming, doing this book. And writing the book is one thing, but trying to promote it and organizing book tours and around the country has turned out to be even more work.
And one of the reasons that I'm able to talk to you, I even thought about it, was because Rita Webb reminded me I should talk to you. She's quite aware of that. She's been working on arranging. You're going to be here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, from your home in Northampton, Massachusetts. On May 16th, you'll be right here in Eau Claire. I believe you're speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at 6:30 p.m. on that Thursday. But before that, you're actually going in the Twin Cities for a couple days. Just give me an idea of some of the places you're touring so our listeners across the country, we have listeners in Massachusetts and Tennessee and California and everywhere. Give us some idea, because I don't see online any full idea of your itinerary.
Yeah, well, I've started, the book was launched in the UN building in New York, and I did book talks in several in Massachusetts, in Boston, and in New York, and in Washington, D.C. We just went out to California, had about 8 different venues out there from north of San Francisco down to Santa Barbara. And I'm out in Kent State University next week. I'm in New Jersey this weekend. We're going up to Maine, to Bar Harbor, Bangor, and Portland with book talks there. Done several online, got more coming up before we're in the Minnesota, Wisconsin, Midwest tour that you just mentioned. Be in the Twin Cities on the 14th and 15th May, and then over to Warsaw, and then down to Viroqua, and over to Milwaukee. All that's all in May. And then I'm going to be in the UK, where, as you know, I lived most of my life. And my grandkids are there, and we're going to be doing book talks in London, Leeds, and Edinburgh.
Wow. And how much is the carbon load for your visiting, for your touring for the book? It's one of those questions one has to ask.
Yeah. I mean, I try to limit the carbon load, and we do hire electric vehicles wherever we do our traveling, which is a new thing that's possible, which is great. But yeah, getting across the Atlantic is a lot of carbon, and I need to do it because my grandkids are over there.
Actually, a little bit of a side detour here we can take. I was trying to arrange a friendly folk dancer tour. I'm an international folk dancer, and the Friendly Folk Dancers is a Quaker group who has a ministry of world peace through international folk dance. We've toured in probably 15 different countries, I think, along the way. It's been quite a while since we've been to Scotland or England, and we were setting something up there, and we got shut down because the Quakers there, who would have hosted us, were concerned about the carbon load for bringing people in from both U.S. and it would have been from Rwanda and Kenya and so on. I felt very mixed about it, right? Because in part, I think we get world peace when we know the other person and we consider them part of our family. And when we dance in their shoes, as we do with international folk dance, that helps achieve it. So there's something about this expenditure that we have to do right now for the eventual good that it's hard to measure it.
Yeah. You know, it's also in my book, it's part of the complication that I think people need to understand, because we're constantly being told all the things that we individually must do to stop climate change. And of course, there is a germ of truth in that, and we all have to pay attention to that, and we have to do things differently. But the reality is that globally speaking, 1.7% of all carbon emissions comes from air travel, which is not anywhere near as much as from cars, for example. I mean, it's 10% from cars and 1.7% from planes. So on the global picture, you know, air travel is not our number one priority. It's not anywhere near the extent to which people have taken it as their one major contribution to climate is to not fly anymore. And as you said, you know, flying is something, I mean, visiting other countries is important and meeting in person is important. Although Zoom is a great technology and there are other ways of communicating as well. But I'm working very, very hard on pushing the future of electric flight. You know, it's already here. There are plans for major airlines to move over to electric planes. There's alternative fuel possibilities with hydrogen and so on. We have to be moving in that direction, but that's going to take time. And it will also involve changes to the way we do air travel, because you can't expect to jump on an electric plane and fly for, you know, 24 hours to New Zealand or whatever. It's going to be in shorter hops and it's going to take time, and we have to get used to that kind of changes. But electric planes are coming, and we will be able to, in good conscience, eventually communicate with people in other countries, which, as you said, is very important for world peace.
The thing that was true about friendly folk dancers, it certainly is possible for a person to folk dance in their home. And certainly during COVID, we learned some of the great resources through Zoom, number of things we can do. But there are some embodied things that we can't do just visually. And dancing in another person's shoes is something we don't do if we're not holding hands next to them. It's certainly a challenge. Let's talk some more about these scattergun items that I want to address. One of them you just mentioned for flights, alternative fuels, and there's hydrogen as a fuel that you consider. And again, folks, when Timon Wallace is talking in his book, Warheads to Windmills, Preventing Climate Catastrophe and Nuclear War, this is an in-depth look at the details. This is not just hand-waving, okay, we know this will be good. This considers the minutiae that are so important to understanding this. So you talk about hydrogen, and hydrogen isn't just one thing as an energy source. There's different colors. You refer to rainbow hydrogen along the way. Give people an idea what we're talking about with hydrogen.
Well, hydrogen is an interesting fuel because it doesn't produce carbon when it's burnt, carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases, so that's good. It's more like a battery in the sense that it's a way of storing energy, because it takes energy to create the hydrogen. You can't just get hydrogen and pump it out of the ground like oil. You have to make it. And so 99% of the hydrogen that's currently made is made with fossil fuels. So we're actually, you know, we're talking about just another form of burning fossil fuels. I mean, they burn the fossil fuels to make the hydrogen, and then the hydrogen doesn't cause more carbon, but you've already used the carbon. You've already poured the carbon out by making the hydrogen. That kind of hydrogen, as you said, you know, there's all these different colors, gray, blue, green, pink. I can't remember what the other colors are, but I mean, depending on how the hydrogen is made. So green hydrogen is hydrogen that is made 100% from solar power or wind power. And as I said, it can be used as a way of storing that power because, you know, as we know, the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. So batteries have made huge progress. And we're now, you know, even just a few years ago, nobody imagined that we could start relying on batteries to store electricity to the extent that we would need to. But now it's totally feasible to do that in theory. But another way of storing it besides conventional batteries is to use wind power, for instance, offshore wind, to create hydrogen, because you can store the hydrogen, you can send it in pipes, and you can keep it until you need it. So that, I don't know if that answers your question, but you know, there are all these different kinds of hydrogen. The key thing is how the hydrogen is made.
I was curious if, see, I'm very aware that hydropower has been around for a long, long time, including its use for producing electricity. There was always an issue of, well, you're producing this power, but the usage of electricity goes up and down in the course of a day and the temperature outside and so on. So I was just wondering if hydro stations had ever dabbled in producing green hydrogen back in the day, because, you know, they have those off hours. It's still there running. Why not use it for something?
Well, to my knowledge, there hasn't been hydrogen produced from hydropower. It's kind of a no-brainer, as you say. But, I mean, hydropower is another way of storing energy, because they can turn off the turbines when they don't need the water, and the water stays or even gets pumped back up a hill or whatever into the reservoir so that you can use it when you need it. Another really great suggestion from the...
We could have delayed the release of this book by decades just by asking...
The next edition.
Yeah. Let me hop to another topic that is of some interest to me. I'm well aware of the wonderful work being attempted by the Citizens Climate Lobby. And the main device that they've settled on or advocated for legislatively has been carbon tax pricing. And I get the idea that you're not as hep on this idea as maybe the Citizens Climate Lobby is. What's your take on that?
It sounds good in theory, and some countries and some parts of the country have experimented with different carbon taxes and carbon pricing, and you know, there's interesting research around, you know, how effective it's been. And generally speaking, the problem with carbon taxes is that it raises the cost of everything. As I said, when you talk about the way things are right now, even an electric vehicle is using a lot of carbon in the production and manufacture and transportation of the vehicle. So if you tax carbon, you're not necessarily going to target the right things, because everything gets more expensive, because everything is using carbon at the moment, and especially things that affect poorer communities and poorer people, like food and transportation and, you know, basic necessities go up. And there's all kinds of ways of redressing that, you know, by redistribution of the taxes, but that also has its costs and overhead to do that. So it's just a very cumbersome and not very effective way of doing what we have to do by making laws and spending money to actually make these changes.
One optimistic sign that I heard just recently was something like, I don't know, the last half of this past month or something, California has produced more electricity than it used for almost all of the days in a 2-3 week period, something like that. You mentioned earlier that Germany got rid of its nuclear plants, in part because it's increased a lot of alternative energy. How close are at least isolated areas or discrete areas to achieving the 2030 or the 2050 objective? Are we getting close anywhere?
Yes, we are. I mean, in terms of energy production, I mean, there's a lot of pieces to this, and the electricity production is certainly the most important, and we are making huge advances in some places, including China. I mean, you know, all these countries are still pumping out carbon, and they're still using fossil fuels, but they're also advancing the clean energy options at the same time, which is confusing, but China is the leader in clean energy production right now. California, as you mentioned, Denmark, Germany, UK. UK has got a huge amount of wind power producing its electricity right now. So there are enormous progress in different places, but it doesn't add up to what we need. And this is one of the difficulties of focusing on clean energy without looking at how to get rid of the fossil fuel production, because we're still, you know, we're doing both at the same time. We've got to cut down the fossil fuels. That's the critical thing.
Again, the book has three, or I guess maybe four, discrete areas that we need to consider. One is about the climate crisis. One is about nuclear weapons. And then the warheads to windmills talks about that. And then the agenda for survival. And maybe to finish up here with this Spirit in Action interview with Tim Wallace, we need to talk about the specific agenda. I was amazed the degree of granularity that you've looked at, how you can move this person, this city, this village board, this state, this country, how you can leverage all of that. There is some amazingly deep thought there. Can you give me some of your observations about some of what we need for survival, how we're going to get there, what the agenda really needs to be?
Yeah, sure. Well, a big part of the final section is about the fact that, you know, the companies that make nuclear weapons and fossil fuels are what is holding us back from doing all the things that we know we have to do. We have to work on government changes, but these companies have a lot more power and influence than we have as citizens, as voters, and we have to be putting pressure on these companies. And there are ways to do that. We know that. We've done this many times in many other campaigns and movements, whether it's getting rid of apartheid in South Africa, influencing, you know, Nestle baby milk formulas, you know, all these different things that put pressure on companies to get the companies themselves to be our allies in getting the government on board. That's what the basic argument is in the book, in the final section. And we know we can do this. We have lots of experience of doing it. I did my PhD research in the 1980s on how this technique, you know, this strategy worked in the 1980s on getting Ronald Reagan from being the biggest supporter of nuclear weapons and the biggest opponent of Russia to shaking hands with Gorbachev and signing away most of our nuclear weapons during that time. One of the primary reasons that he was pushed into doing that was the pressure that was being put on these companies. General Electric, I don't know if you personally remember the national boycott of GE light bulbs, which had such an effect on General Electric. They not only pulled out of the nuclear weapons industry, which they were very heavily involved in at that time, but they put it out as a public reminder. And if you look on their website, even today, you will see this notice on their General Electric website saying, we do not produce nuclear weapons or components of any part of nuclear weapons. And they say that because they care about public opinion, and the pressure that they were under in the 1980s was sufficient to push them into supporting having nothing to do with nuclear weapons. And we need to do that again. And already, as I'm sure you know, there's an enormous divestment movement in the climate movement. More than $40 trillion have been divested from the fossil fuel industry, about a tenth of that in the nuclear industry, but that's still a lot. $4 trillion has been withdrawn from the nuclear weapons industry, mostly from Europe, from pension funds and so on in Europe. But, you know, these movements are already out there. They're already growing. And if we can combine forces with the climate and the nuclear disarmament movements to really put pressure on these companies through faith community divestment, through cities and towns, through, you know, colleges and universities and other institutions and individuals, really seeing that we have to address these existential threats. It's the companies that are in the way of us doing that, and we've got to put pressure on these companies, and that's how we're going to save the planet. I mean, we just have to do that.
So that's part of how we're going to save it. You're also going to do your bit towards saving it when you read Warheads to Windmills, Preventing Climate Catastrophe and Nuclear War. There are many threats to our well-being on the planet, and not just the well-being of people, but of all the other creatures that co-inhabit the sphere with us. Tim and Wallace helps address them and looks at them without rose-colored glasses, but with a very open heart in Warheads to Windmills. You can track information on the book down at warheadstowindmills.org. He'll be touring all around, including my area of the world, which happens to be the Midwest, in May. Find more information by going to warheadstowindmills.org and finding him via nuclearban.us. Again, the links are on northernspiritradio.org. Thanks so much, Tim, for joining us today for Spirit in Action.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And thank you for your work. Again, the links are on northernspiritradio.org. We'll see you next week for Spirit in Action.
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.